This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome back to Back to Back Barrys from Guardian Australia, back for a new season in 2026. And as they say in politics, timing is everything, and we're back just in time as the Liberal Party elects a new leader. Angus Taylor defeated Susan Lee 34-17, ending the party's first experience with female leadership after just 9 months. Look, Tony, I think those figures help Angus Taylor in this sense. It gives him some authority to win so decisively. On the other hand, it kind of also underlines that the Conservatives in the party have again consolidated their position or denied significant influence to the centre-right.
Yeah, I think the only numbers that really count, though, Barry, are the polling numbers at the end of the day, not the leadership numbers.
They called the leadership based on the polling numbers.
Yep. And, of course, the only poll that counts is the poll that triggers a spill, is the truth of it, after seeing many of these over many, many years. So he kind of, and I think Dennis Shanahan also took this view in one of his columns, when he announced his resignation, he didn't point to the polls per se, but he did indicate that we were at the lowest of lows in the Liberal Party. And so that needs to be arrested. So he effectively invoked the low polling numbers. And we all know that that is fraught with danger because you'll be measured against that yardstick moving forward. And he'll be given some time to sort of try and improve those numbers. But if they remain at these catastrophic lows for the Liberal Party, you can be sure that people, particularly Hastie, but other cheerleaders for Hastie, will start pointing that out to the media.
You would think there'd have to be a bit of a dip initially because people don't react well to leadership challenges, and particularly leadership challenges based on the polls. But Angus Taylor, at his news conference on Friday, said that if an election were held today, we, meaning the Liberal Party, would cease to exist. So it looks as if he's quite deliberately creating a low floor to give him some room.
Yeah, he's trying to manage expectations there. But again, one of the most important numbers in all these polls, obviously publicly and internally, he'll be judged by the primary vote and the 2PP. Not that we'll probably just start calculating a 2PP against One Nation because they have the larger vote intention at the moment. But one of the key drivers of the vote is who's better at economic management. The coalition primary vote on our last AFR poll was 19%. And perhaps not sort of coincidentally, when we asked who is the best to manage the economy, it was also 19% for the coalition. So there is a correlation there. It has been driving down the vote. And that's the number he needs to repair the most. And if he can do that, that's a lead indicator. And that should lift the primary vote up, maybe not to 45%, but out of the teens.
You say it's his job to repair it, and fair enough, because he broke it. Like, he was shadow treasurer from 2022 to 2025. Amanda Vanstone reminded him of that on Twitter when she had a crack at him and said, "You've been going on about how the party hasn't taken the fight up to Labor. Where were you? Where were you between 22 and 25? He, of course, took that decision as shadow treasurer to reject Labor's tax cuts, and he admitted since then, and he did it again on Friday, admitted that was a mistake, right? But the other thing that he presided over was precisely what you're talking about now. When Labor, and historically this rarely happens, when Labor took over from the coalition as the better economic manager, he was the shadow treasurer. He presided over that. That's a problem for him. He has to own the problem and he has to fix it.
Yeah, I think in the modern Liberal Party, failure has a thousand fathers at the moment. You know, he does bear responsibility for some of that. And Jane Hume, of course, was the finance spokesperson. But it would be unfair to say that they were the two of them were completely responsible for it. That slide had started many years beforehand. I think under the Morrison government, spending started getting out of control. And then, of course, during COVID, it really got out of control, somewhat justified, obviously, but this has been an ongoing problem for the coalition. When we do focus groups and you ask them, it gives deeper meaning to those numbers of, you know, declining support for the coalition in terms of who's the better economic manager. And it's just a historical context now for people. They use words like, well, they're normally the better economic manager, or historically they've been better at the economy. And so they use those sort of legacy frames. And so it's not a more recent problem, but it is absolutely correct to say that at the last election, Jim Chalmers absolutely pantsed him and became the party, Labor Party became the party of lower taxes and smaller deficits.
Yeah, there was another question at the news conference where they the questioner kind of lumped them both together, said, you know, Angus Taylor, that's what you did in terms of the tax situation, and Jane Hume, you made an issue out of working from home and you messed that up, and then she conceded that was a mistake as well. And the follow-up question was, but can't you see the point here? You two, you're the leadership team now. And largely, you were responsible for two of the big mistakes in the last election campaign. That stung a bit, I think.
Yeah, I thought they were very smart to own it in the same way Albanese owned the delay on the Royal Commission, calling the Royal Commission. I think voters will reward you for that honesty instead of using weasel words. But I think it's also true that, you know, the coalition needs to start developing a better narrative than what they have in the past. I will give both of them the benefit of the doubt, and it's all speculative, of course, and the election review has not been released, controversially, in some quarters.
Yeah, but was asked about that, and again, he said that's a matter for the party, but you'd think it's it needs to be put out.
Well, the Epstein files came out quicker than the election review, but I think in terms of, you know, there is speculation that the leader's office kind of kiboshed a lot of the proposals put forward by Jane and Angus. So I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on that and say that their attempts for reform and to offer a better economic hope to voters was killed off by the leader's office. But it is going to nag them, and it's going to haunt them a little bit, I think, this term. And you can already see Labor's in sharpening up the attack on this.
What do you make of Angus Taylor? Because Malcolm Turnbull didn't miss him when he went on television very soon after the leadership change and said, well, you know, he's the most qualified idiot in the party. But he went on to say, you know, they say that he's a Rhodes Scholar. Well, you know, they're a dime a dozen these days. I've got one, and so do Tony Abbott. But look, it's what are his strengths that you've sort of identified over the years?
Well, Malcolm's assessment was a foot rub compared to Joe Aston's piece in Rampart. I'm not sure if any listeners out there subscribe to Rampart, but it is well worth it. Joe Aston is probably the most gifted writer in Australia, and it was
one of the most savage on his day.
I winced all the way through it. So, look, he's got his detractors. I mean, he is well-credentialed, is the truth of it, but he now needs to deliver on that promise, and it needs to be more than just kind of we're going to offer you, you know, 25 cents cheaper petrol. Voters are in the market for some bold reform ideas, and, you know, I thought before Christmas, John Howard gave an interview with Troy Bramston, and so did Peter Costello, and they talked about the importance of pitching the message towards the suburbs and families. And as we've discussed before, when it comes to urban electorates and urban real estate, the coalition have just 9 out of 88 urban seats. And that is, you know, they've got many, many problems, but that is probably the single biggest problem they need to address. And so they need a policy that's going to offer hope towards that constituency.
Yeah, now that's the challenge, because they need, I think really the aim now for, the realistic aim for Angus Taylor and the Liberal Party is to do two things really, and that is to largely hold off the threat from One Nation in Queensland, so limit the damage to maybe 3 or 4 seats or whatever, and then further south, they need to win seats back from Labor. Don't know whether they can win seats from the Teals, but certainly from Labor. They need 6 or 8 seats, because I don't think the aim is, you know, let's be realistic, to be in office after the next election. But they've got to demonstrate that the decline is over and give hope that they can work their way back. Now, I don't know whether you think that's a reasonable kind of aim, to just try and hold off One Nation, pick up seats from Labor in the cities. But there's a contradiction there, isn't there, about how you go about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also true that, you know, the election is around 2 years away, and, you know, I've got a feeling One Nation's vote is more about empowerment than protest, but it could be protest. We won't know until the election night if this will hold. My tummy compass, based on focus groups, and that's always because they're not a predictive tool, is that these voters who are really fed up with the two-party system are voting One Nation to empower them to burn the whole show down.
But they're taking all the votes away from the Liberals, not from Labor.
They're starting to take a little bit from the Labor pile, but the absolute majority of the damage, I'd say about 90% of their vote gain, has come off the coalition pile. But there is capacity for them to start pinching off the Labor pile. And it's mostly in Gen X and Boomers, Gen X in particular, in an incredibly volatile market segment at the moment, which means it makes predicting 2 years' time incredibly difficult because we are living in uncharted waters right now. The government does have a lot of big problems right now. It's just that the Liberal Party isn't one of them. But yeah. The interest rates are going up, your debt is going up. So it is difficult to say with any confidence what's going to happen at the next election. The One Nation vote, my concern as someone who does not like One Nation is that as it starts to climb, it's almost a permission structure. We're seeing this in focus groups where people go, it's no longer a fringe party of 6 or 8% that was perceived by many voters to be a racist party, perceptually. Mm. But as their vote climbs, it's a proof point to voters that like, oh, well, it's not racist, it's a 30% now. 30% believe this. So it's a permission structure to grow that vote. So I'm concerned that it starts taking people off the Labor pile and their vote continues to grow. That said, it must be said that Pauline and Barnaby don't have a great reputation for playing well with others. Yep. And other attempts to hold the One Nation party together has failed spectacularly. It's going to be interesting to see how that dynamic goes over the next 2 years as well.
Yeah, 1998 Queensland, where they won 11 seats and then 3 years later they had none.
Yeah.
They just lost their own members. But just, I was looking though very carefully, listening very carefully to Angus Taylor in the news conference to kind of pick up some sense of how he intended to handle that dilemma. Trying to hold off One Nation on the one hand, trying to pick up seats in the more progressive parts of the country and the cities. And he talked about two things. He promised a better standard of living on the one hand and protecting our way of life. Now, I suggest the better standard of living will be aimed at those seats further south and certainly in the cities, and there are all sorts of ways you can do that, but we don't know yet what he plans to do in terms of, except he says he will fight all of the bad taxes and he'll make sure this time around that the Liberal Party is the party of lower taxes, but you know, no indication as to how he'll do that. But the other one is really interesting, protecting our way of life. That's there to take on One Nation. It's about migration. His line was that he wants fewer numbers but better standards. So just how much room there is, though, to move on immigration. There are standards. They operate now.
Yeah.
And there are tests, but he wants people who don't hate Australia. Well, they wouldn't be trying to come here if they hated it in that sense, but who will stand up for Australia's democracy and our system and whatever. Well, it's hard to how do you breach that right now? You know, how do you identify people who are going to turn on the country once they get here? That's all ahead of him.
There is a real risk for the coalition in trying to out Hanson. You know, who is the most purist on immigration? I can tell you right now, voters feel that those voters where immigration rates are a really important issue, a salient vote-driving issue, and there's about 10 to 14% in our current polling.
Mm-hmm.
But those voters feel that Hanson is the purest option. So I'm not convinced they're going to say, well, you're second best, so I'll give you my vote. So they've got to be careful. The better prospect for them, in my opinion, is the number one issue, and daylight is second, is cost of living and the economy and its relationship to housing. It completely dominates the vote considerations across Australia, particularly in the urban centres where housing is ridiculously expensive now. And going back to that John Howard interview of Troy Bramson, he put forward as an idea, just, you know, off the cuff, that maybe a bold idea might be arguing to increase the rate of GST to 15%, perhaps even 20%, but then offset that with massive income tax cuts. Now,
they did when they introduced it.
Yep. Now, the coalition has a massive structural vote problem that we've discussed before, with Gen Z and millennials in particular, where they're polling at around 15% and in the low 20s with millennials. which is just simply you can't be competitive when that's voters under the age of 45. So it's a massive cohort in the electorate. And, you know, by saying to them, we're going to give you massive income tax cuts, that allows them to keep more of their income and accumulate wealth and assets. Because at the moment, if you're a millennial who's done incredibly well, pulled yourself up from your bootstraps, you don't have a family inheritance to rely on, and you're making great money, but you're being taxed at 50%. So I think that's an aspirational policy that, you know, is something that, you know, Angus should really consider.
Part of their thinking too has to be about what has caused this spectacular fall from grace. And I just want to go back a little over the history of this, because of course there has been the gradual decline that has impacted on both the major parties. But let's just talk about the coalition for the moment, because at the 2013 election they got 46% of the primary vote. 11 or 12 years later, 2025, 32%. So it was 46 to 32. But here's another thing that's kind of disguised by all of that. 1 year ago, when we were sitting right here, 1 year ago, February last year, the polls, Redbridge, yours and others, pretty much averaged out at the same thing, had the coalition of 41%.
Yeah.
41%. And I remember you saying at the time, and I've looked it up just to be certain of this, and it was a reasonable, absolutely accurate judgment to make drawing on the figures at the time. The prospect of minority government for either side was greater than 98%. The probability of a Labor majority government was approaching zero. They went from that 41% to 32% of the election. So what that represents is it was a dreadful campaign. They got so much wrong. But hang on, this is the thing. Beyond that, 32% of the election to 18% now, they have to figure out what caused the vote not to gradually decline over the years, but to absolutely fall over the cliff in the last 12 months?
Yeah. There's a few factors at play here, and you're right, that dreadful campaign lost them vote share as the campaign went on. And we talked about it at the time. There was, you know, Chalmers won the economic debate, the Liberal Party gave it to them for free by not matching the tax cuts or trying to improve on them. But there's a few factors at play here. The rise of One Nation we've sort of seen in focus groups, particularly with Gen X and Gen X men. Now, we didn't necessarily believe that it was going to manifest itself in a higher primary vote for One Nation, but we certainly saw an emerging frustration in that cohort, and that is the age of 45 to 60, and it's particularly with men in that cohort who were deeply frustrated with the two-party system. And one of the really interesting polls that we did this just last month that hasn't been reported on yet, but it was one of those non-ballot questions that can give you a real insight as to the mood sentiment out there. And we said, which of the following statements best represents your view about the federal political system? It needs minor change, it needs major change, it needs no change, or the whole thing needs to be burnt down. 45% said major change. Not a huge shock, that's a very high number. 15% said burn it all down. When you go to the One Nation, people intending to vote One Nation, and it was 26% on that poll, so quarter of the electorate. When you go to the crosstabs, 35% said burn it all down. So you know that One Nation vote, there's grievance and frustration with the two-party system. And another 43% said major change. So you're talking just shy of 80% of people voting One Nation either want major change or burn it all down.
And when you look at those numbers, of course, most of that decline from 32% actual vote in an election to 18% in a poll now, most of that has gone to One Nation. So do they need to make that their priority to try and figure out why that has been lost to One Nation and go chase that first? Because, look, as I started out by saying, that this result is, again, I think, an indication that there are elements within the Liberal Party who will tolerate They will tolerate a centre-right, but they don't want them to have influence. And we've seen that time and time again. And so would they now be more comfortable in terms of being able to go and try and get back that vote lost to One Nation?
Well, I think the easiest route is to focus on the economy and an economic narrative. Mm. And that idea about, you know, maybe one of those ideas is putting up GST and significant income tax cuts.
Yeah, that's one idea. I think that's the one area where they will look for the big bang.
Yeah, and I think that is more likely to start giving voters hope, because what we're seeing is particularly that Gen X cohort that I mentioned, in the Howard government, they were much younger, obviously, but there was an economic promise. And in most years of the Howard government, 11 years, in most years, there were income tax cuts. In most years, there were at least one or two interest rate cuts. And there was also significant wage growth that exceeded CPI. So there was economic promise and hope for that constituency. And, of course, now all they see is high interest rates, incredibly high inflation, and anemic wage growth. And that is fueling this grievance in the electorate, which is why they don't think the Liberal Party has the answers, nor do they think the Labor Party has the answers. And the One Nation grievance is attracting them and animating them. And I think, I suspect that vote is going to remain stubbornly high unless there's a real implosion from One Nation and unless the coalition can better articulate an economic hope for people. It's okay to, you know, things like immigration, there's probably a few votes in it and a net votes in it. But if you sort of want to go back to another statistic, and James Patterson sort of did this in reverse the other day, but the coalition needs to improve their primary vote by about 20 to 25 points on top of around 19%. Okay, so they need to get up and...
Say it quickly.
40. Yeah.
It doesn't mean so much.
There's 18 million voters in the electoral roll. So you're talking about 3.6 million extra voters they've got to find, give or take a couple hundred thousand, but I'm not going to quibble over that.
Yep.
So they need to be constantly asking themselves, how many net votes are on the table on this policy idea or proposal? Coming up with a stronger immigration policy, trying to be more pure than One Nation, they'll probably lose a few votes. They will gain net votes, I think, on that policy. There'll be a net vote gain, but it ain't going to be 3.6 million. So where do they find those extra votes? Well, the number one issue in town is the economy, cost of living and housing. So that's where the lower hanging fruit is.
A lot of pressure, on Angus Taylor and whoever might be treasurer, shadow treasurer. Jane Hume is interesting because over the years I've kind of, I always regarded her as a moderate and now I'm not so sure. Is she conservative? Where do you think she sits politically these days?
So I think notwithstanding that she probably didn't have the best campaign last time and even allowing for, you know, the origin of some of those policy ideas, there's still a lot of misunderstanding as to how much of it was the leader's office and their processes and so forth. But in her defence, you know, when you do a lot of media like she does, and she does a lot, she's high energy, you're going to make a couple of mistakes.
Yeah, but it's not so much mistakes I'm talking about. It's where she positions herself in the party. I mean, she's deputy, and she's a woman, and therefore that helps to address, not totally compensate for the fact that they cut down the first female leader inside 9 months. But it does provide some balance around that. But how does it sit in terms of the balance of the party, like in terms of the factional balance of the party?
Well, I think it's good to have someone like her around the table. Any political party, and this is where both of them, I think, are losing vote share. Because as much as we can focus on how bad things are for the coalition, and they are, and we can talk about the great result that Albanese got, but their win was a mile wide and an inch deep. I mean, their primary vote was still in the low 30s. So a third of Australians are voting for them. That's not a great total. And, you know, political parties these days, the major ones, are best operated when they've got a representative sample of the electorate. And Jane does represent part of that, and I think it's important to have these people around the table. And I think where these things are not good is where you've got a bunch of, I don't want to be offensive to my people, but where you've got a bunch of Gen X men, balding, overweight Gen X men, sitting around a table making decisions about what the young folk think.
Yeah, and I think they need somebody to represent the cities in a way as well. And, you know, Tim Wilson was there as one prospect in that area. He holds one of the very few seats that they do hold in the cities, but she is a senator, but from the cities, so she brings that perspective to it. But there's going to be a by-election now in Farrah. I liked Susan Lee's comment when she said that she's going to just drop out completely from public life. She's going to spend more time with her hobby, aviation. And she said, where an ego is a bad thing. I can understand that. But she's resigning. There will be a by-election. Now, the last time around, the Voices group searched far and wide to find a candidate because they properly identified, I think, that she was vulnerable. And the election result demonstrated that in a way because she didn't win a single booth in Albury. And that's her base. So she's vulnerable, but the Michelle Millthorpe, who was the candidate that the that they found, the Voices found, was a young woman, three children. She was a teacher and a netball coach, and she from a small town, Gindra. She just didn't have the political acumen or the political experience. They did do a thorough search. They really did. They put in a lot of effort. They didn't find the candidate that could beat her. So the question now is, can they start the search again and find a candidate that will meet somebody fresh this time around? And there was the prospect, of course, that the it'll be the Liberals and Nationals up against one another, as they're entitled to do now because the seat's empty.
It's going to be a four-cornered contest.
I don't know whether Labor would stand.
I'd be shocked if they stood.
Why would they? Well, leave it to the independent to try and come through the middle.
Yep, but I think the One Nation vote could be profound. The other thing, too, is, you know, we've been talking a lot about Liberal problem in urban seats. Albury Wodonga is a very significant, obviously, Wodonga is in the Victorian side of it.
They don't get a vote, but Albury does.
but the Albury Wodonga Twin Cities, it's a very significant city. So it has a lot of urban characteristics.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, Baralaba, where my family is from in central Queensland. It's a proper urban city. And so that's one of the reasons why Susan struggled in those booths in Albury. In terms of the regional part of the electorate, obviously it was Tim Fisher's old seat, so it used to be a National Party seat. And one of Susan's problems is she was unforgiven just 25 years later on winning that seat of the National Party. And but I think One Nation is going to be a huge threat there. I think this, you know, she does have a personal following. There will be a segment of voters who will be who supported Susan personally. Who will want to punish the Liberal Party, I think. We're not talking about 10-15%, but probably...
enough to make it that much easier for the independent candidate.
To cause some pain, yeah, especially if that independent presents themselves as a soft Liberal. And then meanwhile, you've got One Nation tapping into that grievance. And all these by-elections, and each one is very, very different, so comparing by-elections always comes with risk. But the one golden rule of all by-elections is, you know, in these sort of situations, consequence-free. You know, it's not going to change government.
Yep.
It's not like it's a minority government and this is going to change the balance. Like, it doesn't matter what the result is. So that ferments a situation where voters can send a loud message.
I suspect the government would want that by-election to be held as soon as possible so that the memories of the leadership challenge are still there and they can cast their vote accordingly. Look, we'll take a short break, but when we come back, I do want to have a quick chat about the visit to Australia of Israeli President Isaac Herzog.